Welcome, and thanks for listening to this episode of CoreCast. I'm Marissa Lubeck. Zoonotic diseases are those that are spread between wildlife and humans and are an increasing health threat in the U.S. and throughout the world. As such diseases emerge, scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey and other wildlife health agencies must embark upon complex investigative work to determine what these diseases are, where they come from, and how they're transferred across species. In essence, it's an ongoing detective story entrenched in innovative science. I'm here with Jonathan Sleeman, director of the USGS National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin, to discuss the critical role science plays in unraveling the mysteries of these zoonotic diseases. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Marissa. It's good to be here.
How prevalent are zoonotic diseases today? How significant of a human health concern are they in the U.S., and does the USGS have information on the extent to which they're spreading or becoming more severe?
Zoonotic diseases, which are diseases that are transmitted from animals to humans, are a major concern for public health. 7 out of the past 10 emerging human diseases have had their origin in wildlife or domestic species. So we're seeing an increasing number and a resurgence of some serious zoonotic disease threats. The U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center focuses almost exclusively on the detection and discovery of pathogens and diseases in wildlife. So our major activities are looking for these problems in wildlife species before they become a problem in humans. For example, in 2003, the outbreak of SARS, or sudden acute respiratory syndrome, very quickly spread globally, caused disease and death in a number of different countries. And it turns out the pathogen that causes that disease originates in bats and was spread through the wet markets in China to people.
And to help quantify just how significant these diseases really are, do you have any information on their economic impacts?
Well, it's hard to sometimes pin down exact dollar figures, but I can give you some facts that I think are quite revealing. For example, probably all familiar with human immunodeficiency virus. It's a zoonotic disease. It originated from a similar virus that can be found in chimpanzees in Africa. It's believed to have transmitted to people from the butchering and consumption of bushmeat. There are now 35 million people living with HIV infection globally, which is a huge burden on the global public health system. Probably also familiar with highly pathogenic avian influenza, the H5N1 strain that emerged in Asia in 1999-2000. Around 200 to 300 million poultry have been culled as a result of infection or as a result of attempts to control the spread of this disease. And that's had an impact on food security in certain countries in Asia. These diseases have also having negative impacts and repercussions for wildlife populations. There's an emerging fungal disease of bats called white-nose syndrome. It's caused by a fungus called Geomyces destructans, which is causing devastating population declines of bats in eastern United States and Canada. Models are predicting that some species of bats may go extinct on a local scale in the next 16 years. And these bats are extremely important because they're insectivorous, and there has been some good studies to show that bats provide ecological services to the tune of about $3 to $50 billion in insect control alone, which is a huge, huge contribution to our economy.
How does the USGS go about testing for zoonotic diseases? What's the process behind the detective work?
Well, our main activity is what we call outbreak investigations. So when there's an unusual die-off of wildlife species, we'll either send a team out to go out and investigate. This is rather like what the CDC does when there's an unusual outbreak of human disease. We send epidemiologists into the field to collect some data and collect some samples and send them back to our laboratories, who will then examine them using a variety of different tests. We have pathologists who will look at the tissues under the microscope for any pathological changes and any changes that could indicate disease. And we have diagnostic laboratories that can then run some specific tests to look for particular pathogens. It's a system whereby we have partners out in the field who are identifying these issues. They'll either send samples to us or we'll go out and do this thorough diagnostic evaluation that can determine what's causing the death of these animals, as well as determine if there's any new pathogens that's causing this outbreak, as well as what the implications are of those pathogens for human health, i.e. could it be zoonotic?
How are such diseases transferred from wildlife to people, and is there a way for people to prepare and defend themselves?
It's an interesting question. Why are we seeing an ever-increasing number of new and emerging diseases? And the general consensus is that there are a number of what they call environmental drivers for these problems. as human populations grow, as we encroach upon pristine lands, come into closer contact with wildlife, we're seeing increased opportunities for that transmission from wildlife to humans and actually vice versa. So it's really that increasing contact. And it can be anywhere from some casual contact to fairly intimate contact, for example, through the consumption of wildlife. The other factor is our global economy and globalization. We're seeing increasing trade and transportation of wildlife and wildlife products allows the spread of these diseases to go much further and much more quickly than they could before. Example of that in wildlife called chytrid fungus. It emerged in the 80s and 90s, has caused global declines in amphibian populations and even some extinctions. And it's thought that that fungus may have been spread either through the trade in African clawed frogs that used to be used for pregnancy tests in women, or the trade in bullfrogs used for restaurant trade. So these global trades and the global distribution systems open up new avenues for these pathogens to move around. So one of the things that we also do is wildlife can be very good indicators of potential problems for humans because they're out there in environment exposed a lot more to these infectious agents, and they can also be a lot more susceptible to infections. We'll often see wildlife die-offs or mortality before we see human illness. West Nile virus is an infection that was introduced into North America in the late 1990s. It's transmitted by mosquitoes. We discovered after it was introduced that crows and certain other species of birds are very susceptible to West Nile virus. And so when you see dead crows on the landscape, it's often a good indicator that West Nile virus is active in that area. And it then allows the public health authorities to start some preventive measures to try and prevent human illness. It's a very good example that monitoring health in wildlife can be very beneficial in protecting human health.
Jonathan, you touched upon an interesting aspect of this disease transfer, which is that it's not a one-way street. That is, humans can likewise pass diseases along to wildlife. What are some major examples of this, and how does this transfer happen?
As I mentioned earlier, that we're seeing ever-increasing contact between humans and wildlife, and also between wildlife and domestic animals. And this disease transfer can happen both ways. So it can spill over from wildlife into domestic animals, and it can spill back from domestic animals back into wildlife. One of the kind of intriguing examples is the California sea otter, which lives off the coast of California, and it's a threatened species that was undergoing some restoration efforts. And they noticed that the populations weren't recovering as expected. So we did some necropsies, which are the animal equivalent of an autopsy, and determined that a number of these sea otters were dying from what's called toxoplasmosis. That's interesting because it's a parasitic infection, and the only host of that parasitic infection is a domestic cat. So it's very curious where they are apparently separated from quite a distance. There's not too many domestic cats in the Pacific Ocean. Turns out all that kitty litter that's flushed down the toilet, feral cats, parasites are shed in those feces. That feces then gets into the runoff, runs out into the ocean. The bivalves, or the mollusks, then concentrate up those parasitic eggs, and the sea otters come along and eat those bivalves and mollusks because that's their main diet and become infected. So it's a very interesting example of how a domestic animal disease has got into a wildlife population through quite a complicated route and caused a major conservation concern.
I can imagine that this human-to-animal disease transfer is where the real in-depth investigation work comes in, since animals aren't able to verbalize their symptoms or make doctor's appointments. How does the USGS go about piecing together information about such diseases, and what sort of research is done through your shop to provide answers to these silent wildlife health questions?
That's a good question, and we use a variety of tools and techniques to try and piece together the whole story. In addition to the diagnostic process I described, we also have epidemiologists and disease ecologists and modelers on staff. So they take or go out and collect data and information and put them into mathematical or statistical models to get a deeper understanding of how diseases are transmitted in the natural environment. The other tool that we're using is genetic sequencing. So we can actually look at the RNA or the DNA of these infectious agents and compare them to historical genetic composition of other pathogens. And that often gives us a good indication of the potential origin of that pathogen. So, for example, if white nose syndrome, we've isolated G. mycetes destructans, the causative agent of that disease. And it turns out there's also bats in Europe that have the same fungus but don't see the disease. So by comparing the genetics of the two strains, the European fungus and the North American fungus, we can determine is it a new infectious agent that's evolved, or is it potentially European fungus that's somehow been brought over into the United States. By knowing that, that helps us determine the origin of that infection and what we can then do to prevent such things from happening again in the future.
As more information is collected and the mystery of these diseases unraveled, what role does the USGS play, if any, in mitigating these diseases?
Probably one of our major products is the data and information we generate. The U.S. Geological Survey is an independent science agency. We provide the science for the management agencies to help them make decisions regarding managing these issues. We produce a lot of information on our website, technical bulletins, peer-reviewed publications, and also talk directly to our partners, provide them with advice and guidance on how to address these issues. But we're also heavily involved in development of tools and techniques to actually manage diseases in wildlife. A great example of that right now is that we're in the process of developing a vaccine that can be delivered by mouth to prairie dogs, which are a ground-dwelling species out west, to try and control plague outbreaks out west. Plague, which is the same as the bubonic plague that spread through Europe in the Middle Ages, is endemic in West United States. Not a major public health concern, or does cause 10 to 15 deaths a year in people, but it's been a major impediment to the recovery of the black-footed ferret, which is the most endangered mammal species in North America. And the black-footed ferrets rely exclusively on prairie dogs to feed, and they basically live in the same burrows as these prairie dogs. So if you lose the prairie dogs, you lose the black-footed ferrets. And also, ferrets are also directly susceptible to plague. We've developed this vaccine that we can deliver to these prairie dogs that will break plague outbreaks, that will then protect the prairie dogs and then protect the black-footed ferrets, and then hopefully, incidentally, also protect public health by reducing the number of outbreaks of plague in the wild. And it's taken a number of years to reach the stage where we're actually starting to do some field trials with it.
All of this investigative and mitigation work on zoonotic diseases sounds like a hefty job for the USGS to undertake. Do you get any help?
So as we've discussed, addressing these emerging infectious and zoonotic diseases is a major challenge. So the U.S. Geological Survey works very closely with other state and federal agencies, in particular the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, as well as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So we can combine our expertise and our resources to address these issues of mutual concern. And a very good example of that is in surveillance for highly pathogenic avian influenza. We cooperated very closely with those other agencies to design and implement that early detection surveillance system, which again would have be important in terms of wildlife health to detect it early, obviously for domestic animals and poultry production. It's also important for public health. So increasingly we're seeing these diseases that have this multi-agency interest and responsibility called One Health. It's where we recognize the close interconnection between or among human, domestic animal, and wildlife health within an environmental context.
So it truly is a complex and collective health detective story.
It sure is. It's far more exciting than CSI.
Indeed. Jonathan, thanks for speaking with us today. This podcast is a product of the U.S. Geological Survey Department of the Interior. I'm Marissa Lubeck. Thanks for listening.